Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and I'm here now, not here, but I'm in a different place, joined separately in another location by Alex Stewart.
Good morning, Joe. It's good afternoon.
Well, no, it's... Sorry. It is the afternoon. Yeah. And Seb Stafford-Bloor.
Hello, Joe Devine. I mean, Alex Stewart and I are in the same place, though. It made it sound like we're all in three different locations.
Sure.
But we are. Just... I can see them.
Just a twofer. Now, for listening, people who listen to this podcast and never watch it do know we are available to watch in video on the internet. If you visit the TIFO IRL YouTube channel, you'll
see
us there.
Wrong.
And that's why sometimes I reference at the beginning of episodes if we're in a different place, because people can see I'm in my home because I've hurt my back. Now, anyway, lots to discuss today. I mean, so much happened, actually. Burnley, Sean Dyche is gone. They drew with West Ham over the weekend. We'll talk about that situation in a little bit. Brighton beating Tottenham, Southampton beating Arsenal. Nobody wants to finish fourth, except Manchester United, who did beat Norwich. So, I mean, that race is wide open again. We'll be discussing that. And the run-ins to come. Very interesting, that. Manchester City lost to Liverpool, of course, in the semi-finals of the FA Cup, as did Crystal Palace to Chelsea. So we'll be talking a little bit about those games in the final to come. Newcastle United with an impressive win over Leicester. And also, I did a little bit of a European viewing over the weekend. I watched a very fun game between Sevilla and Real Madrid, which we'll talk about a little bit later, as well as 15 minutes of Sporting Benfica, which wasn't fun, hence why it was only 15 minutes. So there we go. But if you like things to be fun that take sometimes 15 minutes, sometimes more, and sometimes less time than that, a whole assortment of amounts of time, you should get The Athletic. If you visit theathletic.com/TIFO, theathletic.com/TIFO, you will find that you can get a 30-day free trial to try to find out how much time you like to spend reading about football, because there really are. There are long reads available, short reads available. I had a great time this morning flicking through David Ornstein's Monday morning column, which is always a fun thing to do, as well as reading Andy Jones's piece on Sean Dyche and his departure over the weekend. Lots of fun to be had. And it took me different amounts of time to read both of those things. So you'll find out that too with theathletic.com/TIFO. But for now, I will leave you in the warm hands and the cool embrace of, Sean Dyche, I guess. Okay, where else to begin than with Sean Dyche, who departs Burnley after over 9 years in charge. I think he was the Premier League's longest-serving manager. He is someone with whom Burnley is closely associated. It seems odd that the twain shall not meet again. Seb, what the hell happened?
I think my instinct is some kind of panic, perhaps. I mean, I know football doesn't really work like this, but I always felt that if Burnley were to go down, then Sean Dyche, firstly, deserves the opportunity to go down with them, but also would probably be best placed to bring them back. Primarily because what does happen next? I mean, the usual names are going to kind of float around the ether until the situation is resolved. But I can't really make a case for any of them being better placed than Dyche. I read Andy's article on The Athletic, and there was some talk in there about players having become a little bit jaded with the training regimen and needing a little bit of a fresh approach. And sometimes this happens. It's not necessarily a mark of a manager's job performance. Sometimes players get sick of the same voice. And if you think of Burnley and you think of this spell in the Premier League, it's kind of been built on continuity, hasn't it? So this was always a risk. But it's very, very hard to rationalize it. And it's very hard to rationalize it now, because if this was a decision made in, let's say, the middle of December, so you've got a couple of weeks of training, a little bit of preparation, a January transfer window, a little bit of restructuring, get some players out, get some players in, that kind of stuff. I get it, but this is very much a, let's just see if there's a short-term jolt out there for us.
Yeah, the thing that I find interesting about it is that obviously they lost to Norwich last weekend, which is quite an important fixture, an important clash for them at the bottom of the table. It was 4 or 5 days later that Deitch then left, it seems like I can understand the instinct to remove someone from their job in such a crunch time as that. The timing of it is kind of strange. I feel like I don't really understand what's happened.
Well, also, I completely agree, because if you're going to, losing to Norwich is never great, and that can obviously inspire some pretty reactionary decisions and some anger. I get it completely. But then
it has done three times already this season. We should point out that I believe three of the managers that have lost their jobs have done so immediately after losing to Norwich.
But then on the basis that you've only got six or seven games left, every training day is crucial. And if you wanted to maximize the effect of a change in voice, like you said, you'd on Monday so that you could have 5 days of preparation for West Ham. And yeah, they got a draw, but I don't think it's unfair to say that they're kind of, they should be grateful to their goalkeeper for getting a draw, because they took a little bit of a battering and Nick Pope did have to play extremely well. But it just, none of it really adds up. I don't know whether in a week's time we'll see what they've done instead and maybe there is a justification. But at the moment, it seems a very tenuous way of kind of chasing Premier League survival. Very strange.
Yeah, a bit of a confusing one. I mean, Alex, Burnley, 3 points behind Everton as we speak, in the relegation zone. They've played one more game. We know that Everton have a really tough run coming up. So it's, you know, it's by no means a foregone conclusion. But, you know, Sean Dyche is a manager who has many years of experience of keeping a team from being relegated, sometimes very last minute. That's not to say this was the wrong decision, and obviously we don't have all of the information related to it, but there aren't really that many managers out there that would be more experienced in this very scenario.
No, and I think the point that Seb made about continuity is crucial, and that's presumably why Ben Mee was part of the kind of coaching team / selecting team for the West Ham game, because he understands how the team plays, sort of like when Jurgen Klopp took over at Mainz, actually, although probably ultimately less successful. The problem with Burnley is that they've played the same style of football with minimal evolutions for quite a significant period of time, and they also have not massively refreshed their squad. Looking at their transfer business over the last few seasons, they have brought some players in. Obviously, Cornet's been quite a successful signing, but it's not exactly been something that looks like it's building towards a radical overhaul. The squad has been built around the style of football that Sean Dyche plays. And so added to that, obviously, there's this kind of inspirational quality that Dyche has. He's renowned for, you know, the sort of the physicality of his training methods. And so to suddenly create a hiatus between that and something new, like, unless you're getting in somebody who's going to inspire survival in four or five games, which basically is what, like Sam Allardyce and who else, you know, it's really hard to see why this has occurred at the time that it has. If Burnley are going to go down, then let them go down with Dyche. Then over the summer, bring in a new manager, overhaul the squad, create a new system of play. That, to me, makes more sense. The best chance of them staying up probably is still with Dyche in charge. So I don't really get it, to be honest.
But there's a couple of things to pick up there. The first is that you mentioned Sam Allardyce, who, at least, I'm not sure if he is right now, but over the weekend, he was leading in the odds as the manager that most people expected to replace him. I think that's extremely unlikely on the basis that he very obviously joined West Brom too late to keep them up. And yeah, that was with many more games than Burnley now have. I think any manager looking at joining at this point in the season with five or six games left, with not certainty of relegation, but a probability of relegation, right? That manager is thinking similarly to how a shirt sponsor with Everton might be thinking at the moment, like, oh, before we sign for 5 years, let's make sure that they're not going to be in the Championship next year. Probably makes sense to wait 8 weeks before we decide, right? Wouldn't you think a manager, unless there was a manager that was comfortable and happy to go and stay with Burnley in the Championship for a year, when you think it's probably unlikely that they are going to appoint a permanent manager at this point, right?
Yes. And I think the only reason that Allardyce is such an obvious choice as well is that from a systems point of view, Allardyce is a relatively neat fit for the way that Burnley have been playing. So it's not like bringing in somebody who's unused to playing a kind of 4-4-2, playing quite a compact system, relatively counter-attacking. I mean, Burnley, you know, there's some interesting things about Burnley, like Dwight McNeil is right at the top of the Premier League for winning the ball back and creating attacking opportunities in the final third, the opponent's defensive third. So they're, you know, there are progressive elements.
He's the only one on the team that's allowed to do that.
That actually gets forwards, yeah. I mean, obviously the departure of Chris Wood, I think, was probably quite a significant issue for them as a reliable source of goal scoring.
Vad Veghorst has had a good start to his campaign there, though.
Yeah, Veghorst is a good player, you know, and as a player who suits that kind of system. I think who Veghorst is partnered with, you know, Ashley Barnes is getting on a bit, Jay Rodriguez not necessarily as convincing as he was a couple of seasons back, so that's a difficult one to see. I suppose that, exactly like you say, a manager is going to look at Burnley as quite a difficult project, because it's not the sort of thing where you can come in and immediately put your imprint on a squad if your style of football is different. You know, there are some very good players there. Like Tarkowski is a good distributing kind of centre-back. Nick Pope, obviously, is a very good goalkeeper. Josh Brownhill, I think, looks potentially quite impressive in central midfield. So there's a spine of a team there, but they are used to playing a certain kind of way and have done so for a significant period of time. And it makes, particularly from a defensive perspective, it makes it difficult to try and get them to do different things unless you're a manager who is already playing that kind of way.
Yeah, that's interesting. So here's a question about the future of Sean Dyche then, because I think he's a name that over the last couple of seasons was occasionally touted as an option for other struggling teams, right? There's been periods in the past where Burnley have been maybe overperforming or performing very well, and he's been highly considered or regarded. For his next job, can you see him getting a Premier League manager job? Or is he going to... I mean, there's not too many suitors. Like, there aren't there isn't a huge number of clubs that would decide they wanted to go for a Sean Dyche style of play. And because he's been at Burnley for so long and they were in the circumstances that they were, it's not really like he's had the opportunity to showcase any other style of play.
I think that's a really interesting point. People say, oh, but Burnley play this way because Sean Dyche does this thing. But it is a product of circumstance. Burnley punching above their weight financially, Sean Dyche creating a system where you can maximize opportunity, you know, his ability to kind of outperform XG in terms of the results that they would actually get was kind of Lucien Favre levels of witchcraft for some time. And so it's not simply that Sean Dyche can only play a 4-4-2 with this kind of particular style. But like you say, like Burnley is, you know, it's not going to be the most attractive destination to try and lure, you know, exciting players to. It was quite weird when Cornet went there from Lyon. I mean, I guess he was, you know, surplus to requirements there. But those sorts of signings are unusual for Burnley because there's not a lot to, you know, if you want to play in the Premier League, Burnley's probably the least attractive of the options there, partly because of the style of football, partly because of the financial situation. Would Dyche do a good job elsewhere? Almost certainly. And I think what's really interesting is this season and last season, we've seen a manager in David Moyes who was very associated with quite a prosaic style of football, the ability to leverage the transfer market to turn, you know, good, cheap players into pretty good ones. Dyche probably has that opportunity to do that. Everton doesn't seem like the worst shout for him. You know, if that doesn't work out, and I don't mean if Everton get relegated necessarily, but I think there is an opportunity for him to do a good job at that kind of club. Watford, potentially, if they decide the Hodgson experiment hasn't worked and or get relegated, again, an opportunity for him there, though whether that would be in the Premier League or the Championship remains to be seen. But a lot of football clubs now are looking at playing a brand, quote unquote, of football that is exciting and fast. And they look at a Jurgen Klopp or a Pep Guardiola and say, obviously we can't hire these guys, but we want to try and hire somebody that can play a style of football that is similar to that, because that's what people want. People want excitement and they want to see pace and they want to see pressing and so on. And that makes the pragmatism of someone like Dyche probably less appealing to many boards of directors than it should be, given his experience, his overperformance, his obvious ability as a coach.
There's another element to this as well. It's something that I was thinking about when the news broke that, well, to be announced still, of course, that Ten Hag's appointment at Manchester United. Something I was thinking about in relation to that and in relation to his sort of dynamic with Pochettino is that the Ten Hag, whilst very clearly an extremely talented coach and has won trophies with Ajax and has some success, he's not as big a name. And I know that doesn't necessarily, shouldn't necessarily mean anything, but it does, because the job of coach or manager is basically a people management job, right? He's got a huge squad of players who he's going to have to come in and manage. They all have egos and different agendas and different ideas. And like, you know, the best football teams, look at Liverpool, and we'll go on to talk about them in their performance against Manchester City this weekend. But that performance was a perfect example of a team in harmony. Everyone pulling in the same direction, everyone doing exactly what the coach wants. With Sean Dyche, he was enormous at Burnley, right? His aura was huge and pervasive and everywhere. And that goes for all of the journalists that would be there in the media arenas, all of the players, anyone that joined, all of the fans. You see the response to his sacking. Like, even though Burnley are in the relegation zone, lots of fans are dismayed that he's been sacked. I think it's really interesting if you take him, essentially, without wanting to be critical or like too critical of this, taking a big fish from a small pond and putting them in a slightly larger pond, Everton as an example, hypothetical example, there's a lot more that goes into being a successful manager at a team than just the what they do on the pitch, right? Do you think Sean Dyche like has the pull and the reputation within football to be able to go in and manage another team of players where he doesn't have the benefit or the advantage of being bedded in for 9 years?
It's a really good question. I think you're probably more likely to find a higher degree of respect for him among professional footballers than you are among fans. Because I think the opposition dressing rooms would look at the way Burnley played and were set up and the ability that they had to maximise the... Obviously, like I said, they've got some talented players, but from a financial perspective and in terms of an overall squad quality perspective, there's not a huge amount of depth there, and there's not a huge amount of, you know, outstanding Premier League quality in most of the team. And I think if you're in a dressing room going to play Burnley, you're thinking this is going to be a hard game. It's, you know, there's stuff to respect. And I think professional footballers are more likely to understand the nuances of that and think, you know, this is actually a guy who maybe could solidify, bring some harmony to the dressing room, weed out maybe some of the players who aren't putting in the maximum amount of effort. The kind of the proper football man stuff that we deride a little bit, but actually I think players probably have a lot of time and respect for that. And it's the fans who are more likely to go, it's boring, long ball, 4-4-2, surely we're past that. But actually, it's not simply that. You know, Burnley did do some more interesting stuff. And also, sometimes pragmatism is a good thing.
Okay, let's have a quick chat then about the FA Cup semi-finals. But let's do that after a break.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Okay, what a lovely break that was. Now let's discuss the FA Cup semi-finals. Manchester City 2-3 Liverpool. This was a strange game, Seb, largely because we saw the same fixture the week before, and this one entirely different.
Yeah, it was as if all the tension went out of it. It was a very loose game, very slapstick, and there were a lot of individual moments, and it looked like not only had these two teams played each other 6 days ago in one of the most intense Premier League games I think we've seen all season, but also they went through a Champions League cycle in midweek, which would have been less than easy. And I don't know, I feel like in a way, in the abstract, the game was sort of commentary on how much pressure is exerted on the modern player and how necessary rotation becomes, and how within the context of the game you had all these kind of weird odd fitting parts like Jack Grealish in a sort of back to goal, not false nine, sort of not quite sure what he was doing sort of role. Mm-hmm. That was quite weird. Fernandinho being brought out of sort of semi-retirement to do a little bit of a hatchet job on the Liverpool midfield, hasn't lost his ability to evade yellow cards. And actually, the one thing I did want to talk about is the Zach Steffen moment. I've always wondered...
Yeah. Well, let's describe this for people who haven't seen the game. Zach Steffen is stepping in goal for Manchester City. He did something which... essentially Edison did almost the exact same last week against Liverpool, where he skinned a Liverpool forward and made a simple pass. Zach Steffen, I don't know, got his footwork wrong in front of goal and allowed Sadio Mane to slide in and score an easy tap in. It was quite embarrassing, and you could see he was finding it difficult afterwards.
Yeah, and understandably so, because I think it's different when someone of that profile does something like that versus how it might have been had the Edison moment last week gone wrong. Because Edison has a bank of highlights already. He has a reputation. He has achieved things. He's won the Premier League. I don't really know very much about Zach Steffen, and I imagine not many other people do either. And so this becomes the dominant association. And I was watching, I was online after the game, and there's a national newspaper who ran one of those awful, oh, look at what everybody's saying about this poor guy that's just dropped the biggest mistake of his career on the biggest day of his career. So that's incredibly mean-spirited. But I emotionally, I don't know how you come back from it. I mean, you see players do it, and you see professional footballers recover from terrible moments. And I've always thought it's a very admirable trait to be able to overcome this sort of slapstick identity which has been foisted onto you.
Well, there are a couple of things to say in relation to this as well, aren't there? I mean, the first is that the expectation, if you're coming in to replace Edison in a game, is that you try to play like Edison does to the best of your ability. So yep. I don't think he was doing something. He messed up something he should have been doing, right? So that's the first thing to say. The second thing that interested me about it was in the 5 minutes after this happened, the ball was regularly left to centre-backs to play out. And I had not been paying attention before that to know whether that was already happening or whether that was just, that was a kind of a reaction to his, you know, psychological wobble after the mistake.
I felt like it was a way of allowing him to kind of regain his composure emotionally.
Yeah.
Because after the mistake's gone in, okay, it's 2-0 and that's a mountain to climb against Liverpool. But at the same time, you've still got, what, 60 minutes of FA Cup semi-final to play. Mm. And I think you have to be fair. It's actually very clever. If this is how, as we see it, it's actually very clever psychological management of a player's state of mind, because you allow him to run through the gamut of emotions, which inevitably occurs after something like that happens, allow him to regain his equilibrium and then return to the game. It probably isn't quite as clear cut as that. And like you, it's something that I probably paid a bit too much attention to in hindsight, but I just felt very sorry for him. It's something about Wembley, which frames goalkeeping mistakes in a particularly cruel way. I remember being at a Football League playoff final a couple of years ago, and while the team ended up winning, the opening goal of the game, I forget who it was, who it involved, that was a pass back that just went through a goalkeeper, Enkelman style, and just rolled into his net, and it's kind of, and he had this kind of terrible like dash back towards his line to try and stop it going in, and it went in, and you just thought, I've never even heard your name before today, and yet this is horrible. And also, you know, on an occasion like that, you become entwined with responses outside of your own fan base. So obviously Manchester City inspire quite a bit of schadenfreude anyway. And so a Manchester City goalkeeper dropping a clanger in an FA Cup semi-final, it's not going to inspire the sympathy it probably should do for a young guy.
No, but I think that's true. It's also worth pointing out that he's American as well. And therefore you would imagine that given that it's an American player playing in a big English football game, there will have been lots of American eyes from home as well. We don't want to take anything away from Liverpool, though, who were absolutely outstanding in the first half. They scored all three of their goals in the first half, if I'm remembering correctly, and just looked unbeatable. At times it looked like they were going to score more. It could have, you know, I was not expecting that at all, but maybe it is a virtue of the fact that they played fewer minutes midweek, the slightly easier opponent potentially. They just didn't seem to have dropped off at all. Did they have a bit of the psychological edge here, do you think, also being just behind City in the league table?
I don't know about a psychological edge. I certainly felt like they played a bit more freely. So the third goal is an absolute work of art, and it's full of, if you look at it like piece by piece, full of expression. That big long crossfield pass from Trent Alexander-Arnold, it's like watching someone play football in the park. Admittedly to an incredibly high standard, but you know, sometimes you see goals which are very intricate but obviously seem very, you know, that have been deliberately designed. They're automatisms. This is a kind of free-form football, players just doing things that they're good at, and then that Mane finish at the far post is just ludicrous. Like it's very similar to the, you remember the Rodrigo cushioned volley from that Luka Modric pass that everybody lost their mind over. Mm. Very similar to that, just a lovely, composed, easy, almost lazy finish. So I don't know. I don't know where psychological edges come from for Liverpool, because I don't know where you'd find one. You're behind, and also it's not as if the pressure's off, because there's a lot of talk about them being able to complete a quadruple. So I think they're under, if not the same amount of pressure, arguably a little bit more. They've got an opportunity to do something historic. So it's like, do you remember when Man United did their treble in 99 and every game had a little bit more resonance to it, a little, it kind of, you know, the air got a little bit thinner around them as the games went on, you know, and they kind of had these little stutters, like they went a goal behind against Tottenham at Old Trafford on the day they clinched the title. They were a little bit ropey against Arsenal in that semi-final. Obviously, they made a couple of mistakes. Roy Keane gets sent off. Phil Neville concedes that penalty to Ray Parlour. Like, these things start to happen. I think when you have a target on the horizon that you're walking towards and the discussion around you gets aimed towards it, I think that's actually a really difficult position to be in. And also, no one cares if Manchester City win the FA Cup or not. It doesn't matter because Manchester City's be-all and end-all is the European Cup. And even to the point where it doesn't actually matter if Man City win the Premier League because no one's interested in that as an achievement. So I think Liverpool are actually, to produce a performance like that under those conditions, actually really interesting.
Sadio Mane, who was outstanding in the game, probably Liverpool's best player, it interested me a little bit purely because JJ Bull, probably the worst football pundit of all time, has been talking...
Certainly the worst I know.
The worst I know. I'm sure there are worse out there that we don't know. Has, you know, said a couple of times earlier on in the season, Sadio Mane dropped off a little bit. This is partly in response to Luis Diaz arriving and, you know, that Liverpool front three being rotated a lot more this season than it has been previously. He was incredible. I mean, he was so, so good in the game. It felt like he was totally at his best.
It's almost quite hard to comment on because it's not like we're seeing things from Mane that we haven't seen before. It's just been this kind of long run of excellence that every time it wavers. And you're right, like he didn't, towards autumn, winter, he wasn't that great. Went away to AFCON. I feel like that's a little bit of a distraction because that was a, you know, a historic opportunity for him with Senegal. But I wonder also whether, like, I know we talked about Luis Diaz and I know Diaz's arrival was framed as a challenge to Mane, but I wonder if it's also quite freeing because if you think about the responsibility those three Liverpool forwards have had over the last, what is it, 5 years? Maybe, let's call it 5 years. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, you have not only a couple of young players there, sort of Curtis Jones, Harvey Elliott, players like that. You also have someone who, I think we can all agree that, like, it's pretty easy to see Luis Diaz grow into a world-class player. You can probably see that happening in a couple of years. I think he's already fantastic. It doesn't matter so much if a player like Mane has an off game. It doesn't attract quite as much attention as it probably used to. In the same way that if you have a three-piece orchestra and one of your instruments is out of tune, everybody notices it, right? Mm. Whereas if you're a bigger ensemble and you've got five Diazes over there, a couple of Salahs, a Firmino, and etc., you know, your failures, your inadequacies, your drops in form, your kind of your off days, it doesn't matter as much. And Mane seems to have grown into that space a little bit. Like he's playing, we talked about the kind of the freedom within that Liverpool, that third Liverpool goal. Feels like that's indicative of where he is, just playing freely, showing everybody what a good player he is week in, week out. Also, I feel like, very strange thing to say this, but if you go back to that 2-2 last weekend, it's like the finish that he produced and the run that he produced for that goal has gone a little bit under the radar. Not that anything at all about Liverpool Man City goes under the radar anymore, but you know what I mean? It's just quality. Like in the moment where you either score that, you either take that chance or you're probably out of the title race, right?
Yeah.
Ram in the top corner.
Yeah,
Fair enough. I think sometimes we're kind of guilty of taking that kind of stuff for granted. He's just been he's a great player for a very, very long time. And
he interests me because I think by virtue of the fact that he plays alongside Salah, will always be remembered as the second of those two or of the three. And I think he has to be one of the second best players in a team ever. I mean, I was genuinely the other day, maybe this is a video, a TIFO video in the future we can talk about after the podcast.
He's your Scottie Pippen to Salah's Michael Jordan.
He's the Scottie Pippen. There you go.
Right. Yeah. See, I've watched The Last Dance. I know basketball.
There you go. You and everyone else in the world. Alex Stewart, Chelsea will go to face Liverpool in the final of the FA Cup because, of course, Chelsea 2-0 Palace. Now, this was a game that I feel like no one watched other than Chelsea and Palace fans. It seemed like the result was predetermined just by virtue of the scale and financial wealth of the teams. Did it play out as expected?
It did. It was kind of boring. And I think it was kind of boring in a way that credits Palace, because obviously they were without Conor Gallagher, who's been their outstanding player this season, among, you know, some quite good acquisitions, actually, people like Guin, Anderson. But Gallagher's the one who's produced the drive, and he couldn't play because Chelsea, his parent club, said, you shall not have an FA Cup semi-final for the experience or fun or because you deserve it, because we want to win.
Sure.
And I obviously, you know, whatever. But Palace under Patrick Vieira, who obviously has a great personal record in the FA Cup, did a really good job of stifling the game. I think Palace knew that their best opportunity was to try and get Zaha and Etzi making runs at exposed centre-backs when Chelsea overcommitted. So they tried to compress the midfield, make it really difficult for Chelsea to play through the lines and then hit them on the counter. There were a couple of moments where that looked like it could work, but they just weren't good enough. Mm. And I think the two interesting things for me were the... Tuchel has been much more flip-floppy in his use of a back three and a back four this season. He seems to have reverted properly to a back three now, and the use of Alonso and Azpilicueta as wingbacks who actually invert an awful lot. Azpilicueta a number of times was Chelsea's centre forward effectively. Alonso making a similar run created the space for Mason Mount to be able to make his goal, which is a really nice little finish. And then by playing Reece James as that third centre-back, you've got somebody who's got a lot of dynamism but can push very, very directly up into the right half space. And then with someone like Havertz who can drift out wide right, it gives Chelsea a lot of rotations and a lot of opportunities. I feel that's a thing that they really benefit from using the back 3-4. That's a horrible sentence. My apologies for that. When they use the back 3... they can do that stuff, and it's what made them so good last season. And I don't quite understand some of the rationale for his system changes this season. But yes, they're still there. The only other thing worth mentioning, I think, was Ruben Loftus-Cheek, who scored a lovely goal. Yes, it had a bit of a deflection on it. But I was looking at Ruben Loftus-Cheek as this kind of, you know, seldom plays, particularly when Chelsea are using the double pivot in midfield, which makes sense. And then you've got someone like Mount, you've got Werner, Havertz, blah, blah, blah. But if you look on FB Ref, his numbers are insanely good. Apart from goal scoring, as a midfielder, he's basically top 30% or better for almost everything offensively. So this is a really skillful, creative, interesting player. Good physicality, good engine, and yet he just seems to be drifting a little bit there, and it puts me in mind of players also like Callum Hudson-Odoi, who's barely got a look in again towards the second half of the season. You know, Chelsea are sitting on some interesting talent, and if there is a bit of a drain, as there may well be, it was interesting as well, they started with three defenders, all of whom may be able to leave the club on free transfers in the summer. That's a pretty big shakeup coming at Chelsea. And obviously they had that period of the transfer ban when Frank Lampard was in charge, and that was the opportunity to bring some of these younger players through. And it's really interesting, I think, to look forward to what may happen this summer if Chelsea is still under some sort of financial embargo, because there are good players there. And I think seeing Loftus-Cheek having such a good game was a reminder of that.
Yeah. Okay. Just another quick word on Palace. Currently 13th in the table, 37 points, you know, well shot of the relegation zone. Patrick Vieira came in, and as discussed, and we've covered this in Tifo videos earlier in the season, they had a really good transfer window. They've built something really cool there, haven't they? I mean, I think based on the performances last season, where what the expectation for that team was, they've far exceeded that, Alex.
I think they have. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on behind the scenes there as well, which Matt Woosnam is covering really well. For the Athletic, obviously there's this big training center that they're bringing up, and Palace have a fantastic catchment area. You know, Southeast London is a place where you can find really exciting footballers, and they've used the transfer business to bring in some experienced players, but also to snap up these exciting young players from the Championship in Elise and Etse the season before. Someone like Zaha, the continuity that he provides and having been there for such a long time, I think is really important. Mitchell made quite a bad mistake for one of the two Chelsea goals, I think the first one, but again, really promising left back coming through there. Yeah. So you can see something quite exciting building at Palace, and Vieira obviously has got those players really on side. I think having some of them being brought in at his behest is part of that. But if they can add some quality up front, I think that's really where they're lacking currently. Mateta's not really worked out. When you're chasing a goal and you're bringing on Jordan Ayew, that's, you know,
Seb disagrees.
Well, I, for a long time, I was in the Mateta isn't good enough camp. I just think I've seen a little bit of him this season, which is...
I'm not saying he's not good enough.
Okay.
I'm saying that it's not worked out yet.
Okay.
And that's the area where I would... I mean, obviously, they're going to lose Gallagher, and that's a huge problem for them. But yeah. I think you can find... I mean, you know, we'll probably talk about it at some point, but if you look at, like, Brighton's midfield, for example, players who can...
We shall talk about that
and do stuff. You know, you can find them if you scout cannily, right? And Brighton are, oh, they're so good at that. But if Palace can find somebody to sort of replicate what Gallagher can do and also find somebody who is just a bit more reliable at scoring goals, which has been a Palace problem for a while, to be fair,
100%.
Then, yeah, I think there's something quite exciting happening there.
Well, it's interesting because like goals seems to have been a problem for Palace for a really long time. Like if you think about the solutions they've tried to... use Benteke, Sorloth.
It's not dissimilar to Southampton. Over the last sort of 6, 7, 8 seasons, they've overpromised on chance creation and under-delivered on actual goals. So, I mean, Southampton have other issues. Let's not go there. But yeah, if Palace can address that, I think they could be on something quite fun.
Worth a little reference to or mention to Odson Edouard as well, I suppose, who started the season very strongly. I haven't watched that much Palace over, you know, the last, well... since Christmas, but I noticed that he has 6 goals and 3 assists. I believe he's their third highest goal scorer after Gallagher and Zaha. A good striker with a keen eye. But I've got no idea what I'm talking about. Anyway, one other thing I wanted to reference on this game was we were talking about Tarek Mitchell before. I referenced a couple of weeks ago, I went to Wembley to watch the England game, and Tarek Mitchell was playing left back in that game. I was sat next to Dom Fifield, the Athletic's very own Dom Fifield, who literally every single time Tarek Mitchell got the ball was standing up and going, "Go on, Tarek! Go on, Tarek!" Making excuses for when he did something bad. So much encouragement. He loves young Mitchell. He loves him. That was a lot of fun for me because I didn't know who he was. Right, moving on now. That is the FA Cup. Let's have a quick break. And when we come back, we will discuss the race for top four, which is just so hot. It's boiling. Tottenham 0-1 Brighton. Now, we will discuss this, but also, of course, we need to reference Southampton 1-0 Arsenal. Now, these are... some very strange things. Seb, will you tell me first, can I say, I was listening to the Athletic Football Podcast on, I can't remember, it was the Friday episode, I think, and they had Charlie Eccleshare on talking about Tottenham, talking about the game that they'd won midweek. Forgive me, I can't remember who they played midweek, Seb, but they won their game anyway.
There was last weekend against Aston Villa.
Okay. It was a difficult game and they won the game, some injuries, blah, 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 blah. The discussion around this was how Tottenham, not for the first time, obviously, but had kind of avoided the cliche of cocking up when the pressure was on. When there was an opportunity to do something, they cocked up. That podcast lasted for about 2 days before Tottenham then went and lost at home 1-0 to Brighton, saved by the fact that Arsenal did the very same thing with Southampton. But in this game, it seems from the highlights, which is all that I've seen, that this cannot be taken away from Brighton.
I thought they're brilliant. Obviously, the theme running through this was that Tottenham were dreadful, sleepy, and I thought it was actually quite a dishonest performance. It felt as if Brighton were just going to turn up, get beaten. It was going to be enough to depend on some of the combinations in that attacking unit. Basically, they abandoned all the things that had worked for them over the past probably 6 weeks. Ever since that terrible result at Burnley, Spurs have been on a pretty steady improvement curve, and this was a huge step back. It was rubbish. But then I think you have to look at what... I think Brighton observed what had gone well during that 6 weeks, because I think if you look at what they were able to do, so Bentancur had pretty much no space in midfield. Some of his progressive passing his level of progressive passing dropped off a cliff. Same with Højbjerg, who looks like a good player when he has time, starts to look a little bit more ropey when he gets pressed. Not a very press resistant player in my eyes. Kane, non-existent. Son did nothing. Kulusevski had a very strange game and definitely should have been sent off.
Bit of elbows,
Well, I don't really understand the rule, because there's a little bit of a tangle with Cucurella in the first half, and he goes from kind of 0 to 60 on the kind of the anger thermometer within seconds and aims an elbow at Cucurella, and the pundits...
Cucurella.
I prefer Cucurella.
I know.
Makes him sound more
You're
exciting.
You're adding in a chef. Well, I don't believe there is one. Maybe there is.
Nah, pronounce how I want, I'll be honest. And he aims an elbow, and the pundit, I forget who it was, said, yeah, but he didn't hit his face, so it's kind of fine. Or he didn't hit him really well, or he didn't make a good contact. It's like, that's not the law. Like,
you can go to jail for attempted murder.
Yeah, and this was not attempted murder, but an attempted elbow, and it was absolutely a red card. I suppose you'd pair it off with the fact that, you know, Mwepu probably should have received about 6 yellow cards during the course of the game and did a bit of a Fernandinho. But yeah, the Kulusevski moment was very, very strange. But I don't know, Brighton's midfield was great. I'm so impressed with Caicedo. We've talked about Mwepu in the past. Alex and I talked about him on a few Sensible Transfers podcasts back in the old yellow office days. And he's been better than I thought he was going to be. He's also, Alex and I were having a little go on FBRF before, and some of his attacking numbers are startling. I always thought of him as when he's coming through at Salzburg, I thought of him as a sort of complete midfielder, but in a kind of 7 out of 10, maybe 8 out of 10 in both directions way. Whereas in reality, I think the balance is a little bit more skewed towards his offensive production. I think it's great. I think Brighton really played with almost a midfield 6 at times. Alexis McAllister was not really a false 9. He just happened to be the furthest player forward. Pascal Gross was in there. Yeah, they were great. Defended very well. Spurs, I can't really think of a single. Maybe there's a little bit of a Son scuff, which he might have done better with, but I can't really think of many Spurs opportunities.
Mm. Lovely Trossard goal as well, worth saying. I mean, I really like the way he finished that, because he scores it with his right foot from the left side of the box. So
the little feint before he takes it is really nice. He does that thing, swerve.
Like at a very at accelerated speed where, you know, when you're walking, you bring one foot in front of the other. He did the thing very fast where his right foot, whilst it was coming forwards to plant so he could move forwards, he just skimmed the ball and moved it into the perfect position at such a fast speed to then smack it again with the same foot. It looked like quite a straightforward goal, but a really underrated finish there.
No, I think it's really well taken. Like, obviously it benefits from, I think it's Romero who makes the mistake, a little bit of a ricochet. But it's just really well taken. The same way that his goal at the Emirates was a week before. Mm. That move he made across the box, into the pocket space. Everybody in the stadium can see what's about to happen. And it's just a really composed finish. I think I want him to stay at Brighton, because I don't want to be one of those people that sort of lobbies for really high performing players to go and play for Man United at the first opportunity. But I'd be interested to see what he could do with like an orthodox 9 ahead of him. Someone who sort of draws defenders in, creates a little bit more space and provokes a few fractures in a defensive line. Because a player like that, who skillful, low center of gravity, good finisher, that's quite interesting. And he could have evolved into a sort of a really prolific inside left potentially.
Okay.
But super impressed. Brighton deserved it, absolutely deserved it. They probably should have won by 2 or 3, actually, I'd say.
Well, Southampton 1-0 Arsenal. First thing I suppose to say, Alex, is that Arsenal have now lost 3 games in a row. Brighton, of course, who we've just referenced, beat them last weekend, and they lost 3-0 to Crystal Palace the week before that as well. Maybe a little bit of inexperience showing, bit of a young squad. They've had a fantastic second half of the season, but 3 games lost in a row is troubling, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the thing with Arsenal is, as people have said this season, they're starting to look tactically like they know what they're doing, but there just isn't enough depth in this squad to be a kind of comprehensive challenger, certainly not for the Premier League, and wavy when it comes to the Champions League spots. And I was on the Ranks FC podcast the other week talking about 3 teams who could have a really good next season if there are certain things that they do, and Arsenal was one of the teams we talked about, and that's basically what they need to do. You know, a lot of their recruitment has been very smart, but they have a lack of depth and they have a couple of positions that they need to address. I think it's really important as well to say that it's not like Southampton rode their luck here, but Fraser Forster seems to have this thing about pulling career-defining performances out against Arsenal. I think he's only had more clean sheets against like Swansea and one other not very good Premier League side. There's something about Arsenal. There was a game famously when he'd just come back. I think it was 3 or 4 games after he'd come back from that really bad injury, when he was, you know, pushing for an England place and considered one of the best English goalkeepers. Incidentally, on post shot expected goals plus or minus this season, he is the best English goalkeeper so far, worth noting. But yeah, he came in against Arsenal, this was 2016, and made like 11 saves in a game, which is not the Premier League record, actually. I think that's still Vito Minnone playing for Sunderland. But they just, you know, some of this, obviously the save that he makes off Saka is the one that attracts the most
attention. Outrageous.
Yeah, it was pretty good. Sorry. I mean, the thing, I find watching Forster quite
He does look difficult. Like Ben Foster, though, doesn't he? They look similar.
But Forster is such a big guy. He's not just tall, but he is very broad, and he doesn't seem to have the agility when he's trying to recover his position. And occasionally when he goes down to make a save, he can look quite cumbersome, but his reflexes are extraordinary. And I think maybe that, you know, he's getting on, he's like 36 now or something, but Southampton's goalkeeping situation is an interesting one because he's there. Alex McCarthy is there as well, who's had some very, very good games in the past and some frankly terrible games.
Is Caballero still there?
Caballero is still there, yes. We had Angus Gunn for a while, but he's gone off somewhere. Oh, he's back at Norwich. It just seems like a position where Southampton have not recruited that well in goalkeeping for about the last 10 years. You know, Antti Niemi and Paul Jones had that position locked down for such a long time. And then whenever you think, oh, Southampton really need to sort their goalkeeper out, one of them has a performance where you're like, oh, no, actually, they're still really good. So it's a weird one to watch. Yes, I know I talked more about Southampton there than Arsenal.
That's good.
Probably not helpful for you.
I wonder whether people are unnecessarily down on Arsenal, because I feel all the way through this run of games, with probably the exception of Palace, if they had a centre forward who scored goals, it would be different.
I think. How long has Lacazette been unavailable? I only noticed that he wasn't playing in this game, and Eddie Nketiah started for the first time in 2 years, I think, in place.
Yeah, but I think the conversation goes beyond Lacazette and Nketiah, because I don't think either are, well, Lacazette is no longer, and never really has been. I'm not sure Nketiah is quite at that level yet.
Well, Lacazette has created the environment for many goals to be scored.
He certainly has. Yeah. And I've been super impressed with some of his work as a kind of almost in like number 10 areas, not playing as number 10, but in those positions on the pitch. I just think that if you look, Partey is a miss. I think, you know, Tierney is obviously a miss. Yes, sure. I think there are a couple of issues in midfield, but if you added a proper number nine, if you added like a Scamacca to that side potentially, or you put a Darwin Nunez, like a proper centre forward basically in there, I think
Diego Maradona.
Yes, Pele. Yes, Pele. Absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
Pele was the one. Diego Maradona wasn't really a centre forward, was he? I made a mistake with my joke. Do carry on.
The honey monster from that advert with Kevin Keegan. You know, someone like that, like a proper target man. Anyway, my point is that at this stage of the season, like if you have that player, you can get away with playing not great and just picking up points. I think actually, so we talked about Spurs winning at Villa the other day. That's a really good example. Spurs got battered by Villa for about an hour of that game, but because they had Son, because they had Kane, because they had Kulusevski, like your ability to take chances is always going to dominate a team that just have a lot of possession, pressure, that kind of stuff.
There is something that's worth saying as well, though, that I can't remember which game it was, but I sent an Arsenal shot map to our WhatsApp group a few weeks back.
Yeah.
And they were really nicely clustered from sort of the six-yard box through the penalty area and back, but they were all in that kind of central area.
That kind of slot.
And a lot of that was because Lacazette is able to push defenders back and create room for other players running into that space to take those shots, exactly like you said, Joe. And if you look at the Arsenal shot map against Southampton, they get some from that region, but they're also taking a lot more shots from less advantageous positions. So although they had over 20 shots and failed to score, which is some kind of record, it's not a record, but it's up there, a lot of that is to do with the shot location. And if you're getting frustrated that someone like Lacazette is not pushing the defense back and creating the room ahead of it for a Smith Rowe or a Saka to run into, then this is Arsenal's problem, is they start taking pot shots from any old place. And even in the absence of Partey, who is the absolute worst for that, it can become a little ragged in that regard. So
Okay.
There's a tactical question for
I still think that... You know, I think they'll beat Man United.
Well, let's discuss this because we're going to talk about... Yeah. We'll talk about Manchester United afterwards. I feel like I don't want to include them too much in the top four race discussion because they have one fewer game left to play than the others and they are 3 points behind. But we will include them. We'll go through their fixtures too. Starting with Tottenham, and there are six games left in the Premier League. Away to Brentford, at home to Leicester, away to Liverpool, at home to Arsenal, at home to Burnley and away to Norwich. So within that group, you would think perhaps there are three winnable games there. I mean, Burnley and Norwich, depending on the final day of the season, probably won't be fighting for a space, but Burnley almost certainly could be. Brentford are a tricky opposition for anyone.
Yeah.
Leicester, of course, a difficult game to play depending on when you play them, and Liverpool and Arsenal. It's not that straightforward. However, looking at Arsenal's games, they are away to Chelsea. They are at home to Manchester United. They are away to West Ham. They are at home to Leeds, which is an exhausting game to play after the three that you've just played. They are then away to Tottenham, away to Newcastle, and then at home to Everton. Their game the one that is being discussed, is the Chelsea game, which happens this Wednesday. It's not straightforward. So, like, the kind of they've got an extra 3 points in the bag is definitely not the case here. That's a really hard run. And it's not to say that they can't finish top four, but for what we've just described, for the type of teams that we have here, for the type of games in which you think, okay, well, those three that we mentioned for Spurs before that maybe are winnable because you've got Kane and Son, who just kind of score goals within games and take points, right? I think if you're an Arsenal supporter, you might look at those now and see the missed opportunities of Brighton, Palace and Southampton just gone. For me, that was the time to clinch top four, and they lost all of those games.
Yeah, it's clearly, I think if you were to compare them, clearly Spurs theoretically have the easier run in, but at the same time, like, you could make a case for Arsenal winning a couple of those games. I think Chelsea probably have a little bit too much for them. But it is interesting, if you look beyond the headline of having to face Chelsea or having to face Liverpool, I think having to go to Brentford is horrible for Tottenham, because particularly the set piece work is aligned around, is aimed towards an obvious Tottenham weakness. There has been improvement between those three centre backs, but I think if you can see a couple of knockdowns dropping into the area between Davis and Dier and Romero, it's a little bit awkward. Emerson Royale, I still don't think he's a particularly good player. He'll make mistakes, so Brentford's awkward. Leicester are a very talented side. I don't think we're going to be in a situation in even 2 or 3 weeks where we know who's heading for the top four. I think you can make a case for any one of those sides in towards it. But it is interesting though, because the caveat with Arsenal is that yes, they can win those games, but they have to play really, really well in all of them. And that is the difference you're alluding to, in that Spurs can be bad at Brentford. They can be hopeless, and then 89th minute, Son, Kane, goal. 1-0, potentially 2-1, they're going to concede. But
this is potentially the difference. There's also a difference when we come to discuss Manchester United, who are currently in fifth place with 54 points, the same as Arsenal, with one game more played. But the expectation might be, if Arsenal theoretically could lose to Chelsea, that could be wiped out. They are three behind Tottenham, right? Their run-in looks as follows. They're away to Liverpool this evening. If you're listening to this podcast on the day of release, on Tuesday the 19th, they're away to Liverpool. That's not an easy game.
Can't see them winning that one, no.
No. They're then away to Arsenal, as just discussed, right? And then there are games at home to Brentford, away to Brighton, away to Crystal Palace. Worth pointing out that they only have one more home game this season in the Premier League. The other four are all away on the road, although Man United's away record has been better than their home record over the last few seasons. That's a tough run. That's a tough run too.
I think you always give the advantage in this situation to the team with the points on the board, just because I don't trust any of those teams.
Which is Spurs.
Well, at the moment, yeah. Like I think once we get to the end of this week, once Arsenal have played their extra game, Man United play theirs, I think that's a fairer picture. And whatever the result of those games is, I think if you look at who has the points, that's probably the position you want to be in regardless of running, just because none of these teams can be trusted. None of them.
No.
There are three good sides in the Premier League at the moment, like three really good ones, and then a lot of kind of teams who think they're a little bit better than they really are.
Sure.
That's that kind of Spurs, Arsenal, Man United group.
Okay, well, the other game for the weekend, of course, was Manchester United 3-2 Norwich City. Erik ten Hag is apparently going to be announced as the Manchester United manager at some point. Erik ten Hag, worth pointing out, just lost the Dutch Cup with Ajax this weekend, so that's exciting.
Guess who was who had a man of the match performance in that cup final?
Was it Mario Götze?
No.
Who was it?
It was obviously Ibrahim Sangare.
It was Ibrahim Sangare, the PSV player. PSV, of course, won the game.
Seb knows that as well. He's just trolling me.
Fine. Well, anyway, I appreciate we haven't really spoken about this on any podcast yet, but this one has now been going on for a very long time. So I think when it is announced, we will discuss it. Up until that point, there is a video on the TIFO football channel that was converted by an original article by Michael Cox on The Athletic, talking all about how Ten Hag plays his football and how that might work at Manchester United. So if you're interested, you can go and watch that. And as and when it is discussed, announced formally by the teams, we will discuss it. But there we go. That was the race for fourth. The only thing left on the list is a jaunt around Europe, Seb.
Yes, so last night you messaged me to say that you were watching Sevilla against Real Madrid. Did you have fun?
I did. I'm delighted that I did watch it, actually. I was, after the first 5 minutes, I questioned what I was doing with my evening. I sent my wife out of the room, you know, and I did think, wouldn't it be better if I was watching a film?
Well, let's stop there, though. When you say that you sent your wife out of the room, how did that work?
I didn't actively send her out of the room.
Okay, because that, it did make it sound as if you actually asked her to leave.
I watched a good film last night.
You watched a film, Alex?
I watched a film last night that was good.
What? And you're telling us now.
Yeah.
Go on.
I can't remember what it was called.
Oh, great.
But Ryan Reynolds is in a video game. It's really good. I also watched Newcastle Leicester, but I see that we've just skipped over that. So that's fine. I feel really good about that.
If you want to do 2 minutes on Newcastle Leicester after this, you can. Or indeed, if you want to do 2 minutes trying to remember the name of the film you watched last night, that is also fine.
Can we dive into your big football brain to learn a little bit more about Sevilla and Real Madrid?
I'd love to invite you into my big football brain. Tell you what, I don't want to trivialize this game, because this was an amazing
classic.
There were some really incredible things that happened in this game. Firstly, in the first half, Sevilla absolutely dominated Real Madrid. It was like night and day. They scored 2 goals, 2-0 up before halftime. And I tweeted at halftime to say I would not be surprised if this game finished with more Sevilla goals. Obviously, I'm an idiot, and that's why that didn't happen. Sevilla 2-3 Real Madrid, who came out in the second half, again, an entirely different team. Here's some observations. Are you ready for my observations? The Ramon Sanchez Pizjuan Stadium is lovely. It's so cool. I love the open top bowl thing. I wish I lived in the Mediterranean. It was all sort of lit up neon pink outside. Very exciting for me. Two very interesting things happened in the game, I will say. The first is that Eric Lamella, who had a really great first half and very much contributed to the team, in the second half was extremely casual with possession. Worth saying, Real Madrid came out in the second half instantly attacking, scored very, very quickly. The whole tone of the game had changed. The Lamella that I remember watching at Tottenham was suddenly there, who just kept giving the ball away. And the third time that he gave the ball away very casually in possession, I heard the commentator say that Julen Lopetegui on the touchline was visibly furious about this. It then seemed from looking at Lamella that he'd noticed how upset the manager was. He'd gone into a tackle to try to win the ball back, and then he'd stayed down and sort of rubbed his leg a little bit because, you know, to suggest, oh, maybe I'm hurt. The commentator went on to suggest that maybe he had seen that he was about to be substituted, and instead of, walking off the pitch, maybe hanging his head in a little bit of shame, he feigned like a tiny, tiny little bit of an injury so as to save some face with the supporters in the stadium, which I thought was very interesting. I've never seen anything like that before. I thought that was very interesting. Another thing I've never seen before, a player, and it was Nacho, who came on for Real Madrid and actually scored their equalising second goal. He came on with a yellow card. He had been booked from the bench during the protest over a goal that was scored by Vinicius, which was ruled out for handball, which is another thing I'll come to discuss. Lots of people are unhappy about that. And he was booked from the bench and then came on and then scored an equalising goal within a minute, which then led, of course, on to Benzema scoring the final goal in injury time. This Vinicius Jr. goal, it was ruled out for handball. The referee called it in live play after the goal was scored. VAR then looked at it. They then sent the referee over to go and look at it, at which point everyone in the world and in the stadium and the commentators are all thinking, well, this is going to be overturned, because when a referee gets sent to the TV, that normally means that they overturn it. The referee stood at the VAR TV for at least 2.5 minutes, which does not sound like a long time, but in live time, that is a very long time. He looked at it from every single angle. It was very clear that he didn't know what to do. He did not overturn the decision. And I think at the time, I watched this and thought, okay, fine. It's sort of impossible from any of these angles to tell whether the ball, which had hit his shoulder armpit area, his chest shoulder armpit sort of trifecta, it was kind of impossible to tell whether it was a handball or not. And so my instinct was, fine, okay, VAR is there to decide whether to overturn a decision or not on the basis of the original decision. So it wasn't overturned. I think this is a real problem area, because if it is impossible to tell, then it should not have been given as a handball in the first place and the goal should have stood. So I think Nacho getting his yellow card for that was, you know, probably reasonable. I think there was reason at least to be frustrated. And of course, at the end of the game, Benzema scoring another goal, Seb, we were texting afterwards, like, he just has to win the Ballon d'Or. I can't see any scenario in which he doesn't. He's absolutely integral to Real Madrid, who are not that good a team at the moment. Yeah. Just winning games purely, you know, they just came out in the second half. They just took the game. They were rubbish in the first half. There was a little bit like some of the European performances recently. And out of nowhere, they just win it.
This is the thing. It reminds me a little bit of that succession of years in which they won the European Cup. And when every year you look at them in like the last eight or the last four of the Champions League, and just think, how are you here? What have you done this season? And yet
they're just winners.
They're on course for they're going to win the La Liga quite comfortably in the end. And they are in the Champions League semi-final. Interesting thing about the Ballon d'Or, because ordinarily you'd think, well, one of the other reasons why Benzema was such a strong candidate is because you'd consider France a favourite for the World Cup. Ballon d'Or vote happens before the World Cup this year.
Interesting.
Because of the unusual scheduling. So that won't be part of the case for him. But I can't actually think of another instance of a player having this kind of late career. Not a, it's not a surge in form, because that implies that he hasn't been playing at a high level before. It's the kind of the evolution, almost like the evolution of his personality into talisman, proper talisman, not just an excellent player, like this kind of all round binding force, which is all of a sudden Vinicius is playing extremely well and Rodrigo's starting to contribute and Modric is starting to pull passes out of nowhere again. He's kind of interesting.
He's secured his legacy, right? The way that people, Real Madrid fans, will remember him in 10 years' time is not as the player that emerged in the sort of aftermath of Ronaldo and Bale, but the player that was there for 10 years and did it the 100%. Whole time and was a little bit underappreciated, but it was clear after they left what he was doing.
He has his own distinct era now. Like there is a Benzema epoch at Real Madrid, and he's already got one title, which he was kind of the driving force behind, which is 2019-20. This looks like it'll be another one. If he adds a European Cup to that, and if you think that if Real Madrid were to win the European Cup, having seen him score back-to-back hat-tricks against Paris Saint-Germain and Chelsea, that is a very, very strong case indeed.
Yeah. Well, two other quick things to say on this game before we move on. Camavinga, it was a shame. He was removed at half-time.
You like him?
I really like him. He was substituted at half-time because he got a yellow after 30 minutes. And then he sort of injured Anthony Martial after 40 minutes and probably could have been sent off. So he was removed, which was a shame because he was a whole big buzz of energy. The other thing to say was that the Rodrigo goal, which I think was the first goal that Real Madrid actually scored, it was amazing. It was a Carvajal to Vinicius Jr., back to Carvajal, into Rodrigo. I saw Om Arvind on Twitter tweeting about the goal, saying that Rodrigo run is something that he's noticed before, from attacking the left-hand side of the box on a diagonal run from the right. This is apparently something he does a lot. It was a fantastic finish, and the move was perfect. Sevilla couldn't do anything about it. So that was lovely to see. And that's it. The only other game that I watched 15 minutes of was the Derby de Lisboa, Sporting 0-2 Benfica. I was informed that Sporting needed to win to keep the pressure on Porto, and then they didn't. And the reason I stopped watching was because Benfica were already 1-0 up and just, I think, sat back and did nothing for the rest of the game.
Do you have any observations about Darwin Nunez? He scored a goal in that game.
I didn't see any of the goals.
Right. Okay.
So
not such a good podcast segment then.
No, I don't have anything to say about that other than it's called the Derby de Lisboa.
Right.
So, you know, Alex, before we finish, did you want to say anything about Newcastle 2-1 Leicester City?
The film is called Free Guy, and you should definitely watch it. I think genuinely, Joe, I think you'd enjoy it.
Sure.
Only thing, a lot of people have been talking about how terrible Leicester are at defending set pieces, and justifiably so. but they worked a really nice one for their opener. They had runners pushing the Newcastle defensive line back. It was a sort of drilled in ball towards the near post for a back heel that was quite deliberately a back heel for Lookman to be arriving into the space created by the other Leicester players pushing the Newcastle defenders back. So that was really smart. Mm. Otherwise, kind of a rubbish game, to be fair. And Joe Willock comes on and makes a nice run for Guimarães to score at the end. But I guess it's more now, what do Newcastle do? They're safe. Some of their players look really good. But the next few games are effectively an irrelevance for them because they'll be fine. But it's a big, big summer for them in terms of how they build and what they do.
I wonder whether the next few games are actually quite a big deal for some of those players.
Oh, for some of the players, sure.
Some of those players are not quite sure whether they're going on this journey yet. Like, obviously, no. Guimarães, clearly, like a couple of players who are a key and integral to what happens next. But there are a couple who, if you're in a sporting director position, I don't know what Dan Ashworth's situation there is. I don't know whether he's actually in the
I
job
don't know
yet.
If it's been confirmed yet or not.
Either way, if you're plotting Newcastle's way forward, you've got a few questions about kind of Shelby part of this. I don't know. Mm. Like Sir Maxman, obviously. But
I'd be interested to be Chris Wood in this situation because obviously the reason to buy Chris Wood is you need to survive in the Premier League for the next 6 months, but not because
and you need to weaken a rival.
Yeah, and you want to weaken a rival.
Importantly.
But not because you want to build a team around Chris Wood. No criticism of him, but I don't think he plays the sort of football that Newcastle are going to want to exhibit at least in the next 2 years. I'm sure he'll be fine next season and he's there for the long term and Eddie Howe seems to like him. But, you know, in 2 years' time, are we really going to see Chris Wood starting games for Newcastle?
But this is always what happens in this situation. When a club comes into a lot of money, you always get the sort of stepping stone players. So like you'll eventually have a Carlos Tevez, but at first you're going to have Craig Bellamy. You have to go through your Joes and your Adebayors and, you know, that kind of stage.
Sure.
And then you run the risk of becoming obsolete because there's always that. If you're in Newcastle's position, you can't shop off the top shelf immediately. And so you have to kind of get there in stages. And I suppose that is always going to create a bit of churn. But I think Chris Wood's done quite well. I know he's...
Oh, for sure.
I mean, I think strategically it was a very good decision. They've survived. That was their job. And they will have survived pretty easily by the end of the season. So,
okay. Well, my wife is saying, let me know when I can come in. So I think that means it's the end of the podcast this week.
Did you send her out of the room again
to record
the podcast?
Yes, I did. I expelled her from the room.
Will you leave, please?
Also, the listeners won't know because of how superbly and cleanly this will have been edited, but this episode's taken quite a long time to do and longer. We're here about an hour later than we would normally be. So, you know, I've had dominion of my domain for much longer than I said I was going to.
Is the atmosphere changing in your house?
Oh, it's putrid. It's putrid. No, it's not at all. Right, anyway, Alex Stewart, thanks to you.
Thank you very much.
And Seb Stafford-Bloor, thanking you.
Thanking you, Joe Devine.
We will be back next week with more. And of course, next week as well, I believe the European football, the Champions League is there again. So we'll do some live streams. But yeah, keep an eye out for all the cool stuff. Thanks for listening. And thanks as usual to producer Craig today and whoever is editing from the audio. I don't know who it is today. Bye.